Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Research and Inquiry in Initial Teacher Education with Shonit David.
Welcome to another episode of Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. This episode is going to feel a bit less like a sort of interview format and a bit more like a roundtable discussion, because we're here to talk about some research that we've been doing just lately with a colleague who's joined us for this episode, Shonit David. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Very, very warm welcome to you. But before we get into it, talking about our research, I think Tom is going to give us a bit of a contextual overview. How did we get here? What were we trying to find out?
Why were we doing this research? Well, people who are familiar with the Welsh ITE context, maybe people who've been paying attention to some of our past episodes, will know that we have a particular viewpoint here that comes down from the government and is sort of replicated here in what we do, which is that teaching is a complicated business. Learning to teach is a complicated business. We're not trying to get our student teachers to just copy established practice. We're not trying to do a sort of, here's your theory, off you go and put it into practice. We have a model which is much more complex, borrowed from our friends over in Oxford, which is why we had Professor Trevor Mutton on a little while ago talking about similar things. Without wishing to kind of go down a rabbit hole with it, what you need to know is that we believe that our student teachers should have access to a wide knowledge base, which ranges from kind of research-based things, what you might associate with university, with journals, with books, with knowledge, that kind of knowledge, and all the way through to the sort of real craft, the real kind of nuts and bolts of teaching, that they should have time in university and they should have time in school, and that they should be able to bring all those different types of knowledge into a sort of interplay with one another, a sort of dialogue with one another, both in school and in university. So they should be coming to university armed with things that they've picked up in school so that they can unpack them. They should take things from university and they should take them into school and try and see what that means when it meets a kind of real place. So it's a really complicated model. And as part of setting them up to do that, we have this thing on our programmes called research and inquiry, which is a new thing. We never used to have it before we started these new programmes just pre-COVID. And research and inquiry, I suppose, we think should be any time that you're not planning, teaching, evaluating lessons like a teacher, whole lessons, not on PPA, doing your marking, planning your lessons, you know, laminating things, whatever that may be, but having the space and time to access all these types of knowledge, from journal articles to books to podcasts to conversations with experienced teachers, observations of practice, little bits of practice of your own teaching, maybe in a lower stakes environment, that kind of thing. We set that up for our student teachers, and because it was new and because it was quite complicated, we started to hear back that, yeah, you know, there was some good stuff going on, but that there was also perhaps some confusion here and there. There was some mixed practice here and there. Some people were imagining it or doing it in slightly different ways to other people. And so that felt like a really good opportunity to do some research, because we could find out where the good bits were, we could find out where the less good bits were, we could find out how varied it was good to be, and maybe how varied was too varied. And so we decided we'd better spend some of our own research time digging into that in a bit more detail.
Yeah. And the only thing I would add to that is that this isn't just our institution thing. This is a Welsh Government thing, and it came as part of IT reforms, and it's also built into the professional standards for teaching and leadership. So it talks about research and inquiry in the standards that are laid out for student teachers in particular to meet in order to gain qualified teacher status. So, you know, we were sort of mandated from all corners really to really make sure that it was integrated and embedded. But I think our hunch early on was that it wasn't landing with ease, but we didn't quite, we had a few hunches, but we didn't quite know why that was the case. So yes, we set about trying to investigate it, which mainly involved talking to mentors and student teachers. We had a sort of reasonably small sample, didn't we? But we produced quite a lot of data from that sample of participants, which included student teachers on our PGC secondary and PGC primary programmes here at Cardiff Met, and their mentors who kindly agreed to take part. And we were asking them to tell us to what extent research and inquiry was having a bearing on their development in their practice, in their sort of professional development. And from their explanations and their sort of justifications of to what extent it was having an impact, we were able to draw out some themes and some interesting findings that were also sort of coming through in the literature that we'd read.
And just to add there, we did interview them twice, didn't we? One on clinical practice one, one on clinical practice two. And then again, those who were still in the process when they had a new post as well, because that turned out to be quite interesting, the fact that, you know, how they viewed research inquiry at different points in their learning journey.
Yeah.
And yeah, big thanks to those student teachers and their mentors. Not everybody stayed for the full round of interviews. Some people, you know, they dropped out for various reasons. I think we ended up with three absolute stalwarts by the end. And what a shame it is that when we do this research, people have to remain anonymous. So we can't actually thank them. But those three people in particular, and everybody who was involved, you all gave us some really important goodies. We are hoping at some point to publish this work in the form of a kind of traditional journal article. So if you're interested in the whole sort of lit review methodology type stuff, if you're that kind of person, that you can go there for that. We're going to kind of skip all that stuff and just dig into what we actually found. And it rapidly became clear, didn't it, that while we had an aspiration that student teachers were going to sort of drive this process of bringing these types of knowledge in and sort of almost like kicking the tires on them while they were in a school context, there was sometimes a tendency for that research and inquiry, the direction of it, the source material, the stimulus material, to actually be driven more by the school and less by the student teacher.
Yes, for various reasons. What we found, and we're not going to go into too much depth and detail about the sort of concepts coming from the literature, but what we know about schools is that they also, in the current educational sort of climate in Wales, are expected to be engaging with research and inquiry. You know, we've had national programmes. You know, there's a real drive towards teaching as a master's level profession, even a doctoral profession. We've now got a national doctorate. So, you know, schools would have been at different stages. When we gathered this data, they would have been at different stages in their sort of journey towards being a sort of inquiry-focused, research-informed establishment. And so, you know, students were going to get sort of mixed experiences depending on where they went and where the schools were in that journey. What we also know of schools is that oftentimes they have got sort of practices that they endorse that do come from literature, whether that sort of has come from a process of looking to literature in the first place, or whether it's come from more sort of consultative, perhaps they've had an education consultant come in, you know. So examples such as Dr. Rice. Tom, you're going to have to define the acronym there. I know you've got it in the article.
I've got it, because we've got a quote from a student. It's really quite telling, actually. They talk about, when we ask them what they've been doing, they say, I've been doing Tom Sherrington's walkthroughs.
Yeah.
You know, if you've been living under a rock, then that's a book of practical teaching strategies. And then they go on to say they also use Dr. Ice, which is this acronym: deepening thinking, role modelling, impact on learning, challenge and engagement. And they go on to say, and this is a word we hear so often in education, so I've hit all those points.
Yeah.
Once. Possibly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so we found from the data that we gathered that in some instances, students were being quite heavily directed towards certain texts, certain ways of using their research and inquiry time, that were influenced by the school as a community of practice who had selected certain approaches, certain texts, etc. And so, you know, that influence, good or bad, was one thing that we found.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes we think, you know, a school can be particularly good at supporting a student because they are engaged in their own research. But then they're very much responsible for the direction of the student's research, whereas we don't actually give the student themselves any autonomy possibly to make decisions about their own learning needs and their own development needs. And there is a danger sometimes for schools to be a little bit too prescriptive possibly in the type of tasks and expectations that they have for student without taking into consideration the student's own autonomy in making some decisions about their own needs.
It's such a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because if a school had absolutely nothing, then the student teacher might be kind of going in and going, well, university's said all this stuff about research and inquiry, but there's nothing here. And then that would be a problem. That'd be a real cognitive dissonance. But then equally, if they go in and they're like, yes, oh, great, loads of books. But then they bring in something which isn't on the sort of approved list, they could get potentially a bit of a chilly reaction. And so, yeah, there is a difference between research and inquiry, which is for the sort of individual and in order to sort of test things out that may or may not work, and then a sort of slightly more, I don't know, more sort of part of the team research and inquiry, which is aimed at very strongly at that joint enterprise of the school.
Yes, yes. And we know from the work of people like McIntyre, who produced a continuum, and there are different types of knowledge that teachers draw upon, you know, that does include the sorts of sources that do the sort of digesting of the big research studies or meta-analyses, whatever, and produce really close to practice manuals, books, professional learning, you know. And if that type of research and inquiry knowledge is dominant in the school, then why wouldn't a student teacher, you know, adhere to that, follow that, think that that was sort of the main thing of value to them?
And we did find, didn't we, that the students sort of placed greater value possibly on those practical things or what they perceived as being closer to practice. And that's part of the challenge, isn't it, really, for them to understand that all these different types of knowledge apply to them as part of the research and inquiry, but that they will always revert to thinking, you know, this is a quick fix, you know, this is, I've ticked off those boxes, I've hit all those notes, you know. And so that was interesting as well, I thought, that the students put that greater emphasis on those close to practice things.
And this, I think, maybe we'll discuss this a bit more later, I don't know. This points to a bit of a dichotomy in the mentor's role, or in the roles of anybody in school who are working with student teachers, which is that they have this sort of aspirational part of their role, which is to be their, almost their sort of guide towards trying things out and bringing in things that might be a bit disruptive and maybe trying some things out that might crash and burn and not work. And lots of school colleagues will be really on board with that. I know I would have been very on board with that when I was a mentor. But then they crash into the brick wall of the fact that they've also got to assess them.
And
the mentor, the school colleague, may be perfectly able to differentiate between those two things and keep those two things, you know, not from being in conflict. But the student teacher's always going to be aware that the mentor's going to be assessing them. And so they may be less keen to be a disruptor, or they may be less keen to try things out that are from outside the sort of approved climate. Even though actually the mentor may be completely fine with it, but the student teacher might be a bit cautious to do something, given that they know the mentor's also got that assessing role in the background.
And I think for me, because I do a lot of work with, as part of the Mentor Leads team here in the Cardiff Partnership, that at that point in time made me realise like how much we were expecting of mentors in this new, in these new reforms, in this new landscape, and you know, their role as a mentor, and how difficult that ask is, that, you know, that challenge of, you know, you're a co-inquirer, but you've also got to be the one that decides whether they're in or out of the profession. Before we even get into how off-putting in some ways, just the terms research and inquiry can be. If you're a mentor who doesn't see themselves as someone who has done any of those things, or maybe even a mentor who doesn't value it. And this was something that we saw coming through in the data as well, was that at times there was sort of a conflict in how the mentors were viewing the value of research and inquiry and research and inquiry time, which seemed to be, from our analysis, influenced by the sort of experiences that they were having right now in education, and perhaps the way that they had been mentored themselves, or the way that they've trained teachers in the past. Tom, you can probably find a nice juicy quote on this, but to paraphrase, some of the mentors who participated in the study were saying things like, well, they're not going to get the time to do this when they become a fully qualified teacher. So why are we giving them, why are we giving them false hope now? Why are we expecting them to do this now when I don't have any time to do anything other than plan, teach, evaluate, do my marking, you know? So there was a bit of tension there, wasn't there, that we found.
And I think the tension might come partly from, you know, the calling of it research and inquiry, whereas really they are themselves involved in, you know, constantly questioning themselves, challenging themselves, developing their practice. But it's not possibly done into something that is called research necessarily. And I think sort of aligning their own development as an IT practitioner and aligning that with the development of their student is difficult and challenging for many mentors.
I sometimes think as well, when I'm reflecting on this, that it's another one of those things that when you are a very, very good teacher, you know, if you are a really top quality teacher and a very experienced one, you probably are doing a lot of that interrogating, yes, bringing in things from outside, trying things out. But it's so kind of mixed in with everything else. It's so holistic, and it's almost like a sort of automated process. And when we're working with new teachers, with student teachers, we have to make stuff explicit. We talk about this a lot, don't we, with just teaching generally, that mentors often have a process to do to unpack things that have become automatic. And I would wonder whether perhaps this process of interrogating different forms of knowledge is also something that a good teacher does, but we have to make it an explicit, separate, visible thing for student teachers. So actually, when they're sort of protesting, when the mentors are saying, oh well, I never do this, you know, why are they doing this, they won't get the chance when they're an experienced teacher, maybe they are not, almost not realizing they're doing it.
Yeah.
I think, interestingly, the word you used earlier, Tom, was disruptor as well. You know, yeah. And we need our student teachers to be disruptors, don't we, in their practising. But we also need the mentors to be ready to be disruptors, don't we? And,
yes,
you know, challenging their own practice and challenging what happens and challenging pedagogy that's used currently, whatever. But, and sometimes, coming back to that whole idea of the community of practice, is very difficult for somebody when they feel they need to belong and share the vision and the values of that school or a student teacher whilst they're there as well, for them to be a disruptor whilst also trying to be a member of that community of practice.
Yeah, and that segues us very nicely to another theme that came out in the data, which was, and I was almost a bit sad about this in a way, which is that student teachers very, very early on in their time learning to be a teacher already appeared to have a well-defined sense of teacher guilt going on.
Oh, they did. They really did express that quite clearly, didn't they? I remember interviewing someone who I won't name, who was saying, I just feel like it's an indulgence. I feel like it's taking me away. If I'm not doing something directly for or in front of the kids, then it's a waste of my time, or it's a guilty pleasure in some ways. And I think this is why colleagues like Professor Emma Jane Milton at Cardiff University and Dr. Alex Morgan, also at Cardiff University, are big on the concept of inquiry as a way of being. I think it comes back to what we were saying a moment ago about, you know, this isn't something new to teaching. Like, good teachers are constantly asking, did that work? How do I know that worked? What am I going to do if it didn't? Where will I look to for answers? What will help guide me? You know, and that is, you know, a very oversimplified version of it's an inquiring mind, isn't it? And so you can sort of understand how if you've got a student who feels like they're mega guilty, you've got a mentor who's saying, oh, and actually I was rereading the quote we've got in our proposed article, and actually they're not as scathing as I perhaps presented them. They're just saying that it's a different ball game when you start teaching, because you're teaching so much. And by the time you've planned your lessons and you've taught it and maybe done a bit of research, so this person isn't even saying like, no, you're not going to get it at all, to find out how you can improve. And you've only got one or two professional learning days in the whole school, you know, then before you know it, the year's gone and you're back to square one again. It's interesting though that they're sort of talking about it there as it needing to be an activity that you have to sort of have time carved. They refer to professional learning days. You have to have time carved out. And we were pondering over the fact that maybe this guilt and the time is a problem of our own making, because we have set aside time in the student teacher's timetable. We allocate time every week that they are on our programmes here at Cardiff Met to research and inquiry. And in a way, just by doing that, you've set it apart from classroom practice. And that's maybe, you know, we've got a hunch that maybe that's where some of the guilt is stemming from, because we've maybe inadvertently, and we know the students and the mentors have said in their various evaluation forms, you know, they shouldn't be out of the classroom. It doesn't have to be. We have to sort of resell it. It doesn't have to be time out of the classroom. So, you know, we've got guilt, we've got different perspectives on it, all challenges to overcome to help this become more integrated.
And it ties in with our earlier research, doesn't it, about the role of the mentor as well, you know, but that's the mentor's role in interpreting, you know, what research and inquiry means, and facilitating it, and engaging in that discussion. They are the one really mainly responsible possibly for enabling student teachers to really benefit from this R&E time.
So it's probably time to just kind of give a very brief sense of some of the stuff we've used to try and make sense of this, because the whole sort of research process is about you go and you find some stuff out. So that we've just described that. We've just found out what people were feeling about research and inquiry, which was, you know, some students felt a bit guilty when they weren't doing something a bit more directly to do with lessons. Sometimes, rather than the aspiration that it was very much driven by the student, it was sometimes geared towards whole school priorities, maybe a little bit more than we might like. And also that mentors were sometimes saying, well, gosh, they seem to be doing a lot of this, and couldn't they be doing more teaching? That's fine and fair enough. There's some data, but you can't just stop there. You have to actually try and then find something that will help you make sense of it. So why is this going on? And then, as my doctoral supervisor always used to say to me, you need to ask the all-important question, so what? Mm-hmm. What was the point of doing this if you can't say so what? So in order to make sense of it, we went for this idea of communities of practice. Now, communities of practice is something that people talk about quite a lot. People have mentioned it on the podcast. I think I probably said last time we were talking about research we'd done, which used this idea, it does get bandied about because it sounds really nice.
Sounds cozy, doesn't it?
It's a practice. And I must admit, I've now, having done this research, I've got a little bit of a bee in my bonnet about people chucking the words communities of practice around, where perhaps it's just because it sounds like a nice thing. We'd all like to be part of a community of practice, wouldn't we? It sounds lovely. But actually, if we're going to use it in its sort of proper sense, we need to go to the work of Wenger. We used Wenger's 1998 book. And Wenger looks at the way that organisations, particularly work organisations, sort of have this informal way of drawing people into them. So you think about joining a workplace. I mean, he uses an insurance company, but any workplace. You join the workplace and you sort of try to become part of it. And the workplace has formal and less formal ways by which it draws people in and makes them part of that enterprise. And there are sort of really interesting things around that. And he talks about the fact that people who are in a workplace learn to be a part of that workplace or that community through their mutual engagement. So, you know, we're all part of this team. Joint enterprise, we have a sort of joint goal. And I suppose you can imagine in schools, that is giving the best possible learning to the kids, and a shared repertoire, which is those sort of formal and informal things that we all share in order to do, to sort of do what we do and play our part towards that joint enterprise. And so what we did is we tried to look at what we'd found out in terms of communities of practice. And that was how we discussed what we found.
Yes. And I think what we noticed, we had a bit of a eureka moment in that, as Sean had mentioned earlier on, our student teachers will go to two clinical practice schools. So, you know, in sort of general terms, they will have two school placements. And applying that theory of communities of practice, we could see that schools are quite strongly constituted communities of practice. And, you know, given the explanation that we've just had from the literature from Tom, we can probably agree with that. And so when a student comes into that environment, they're being inducted into it. There is an expectation for all the reasons that Sean had mentioned earlier on about, you know, they're also being assessed by the mentor in that school, that they will sort of assimilate the practices that they are seeing, fraught by this idea that we're telling them at university, question everything, interrogate, be critical, inquire. However, they will be, and they say, don't they, because we have this period between the two placements, a slightly longer period if they're on the BA programme, where they've come out of it and they take a moment to reflect. And then they go into another strongly, but different, strongly constituted community of practice where the rules might be quite different. You know, you talked about that common sort of practices that and ways of doing things that, you know, they will have gotten really familiar with and assimilated really well, potentially in their first school placement. But then concepts and practices that they thought they knew and understand can look and feel and be sort of theorised as well in a completely different way.
Yes. And I think they can find that very, very challenging. And we know ourselves, don't we, that that's when many problems arise, is when the student actually switches from first clinical practice to the second, and all of a sudden their performance dips because they are reacclimatizing and starting anew to try and join this second community of practice.
Yes.
And then it's interesting, isn't it? Because we did have an argument that the professional standards for teaching and leadership should be the thing that helps them to, you know, make that transition from one community to another. But as to how effective they are, that's another matter, isn't it? But I think,
yes,
you know, with Wenger, it's sometimes the theory of the community of practice is there to help us identify when things go wrong and understand why things go wrong, not necessarily to put in place a structure, but it just helps us better to understand, well, why the learning possibly isn't happening as it should be. And therefore, it helps us particularly to understand why students have that particular challenge in trying to meet clinical practice two requirements.
Yes. And we wondered, you know, has that become really clear to us? Because we are not in a really strongly constituted community of practice within initial teacher education, because we've got lots of different schools in our partnership. We are strongly constituted in that we have a research-informed clinical practice model. We, as university-based teacher educators, go out and can see quite clearly, because we're constantly going into different communities of practice, the schools in our partnership, that, okay, there they do it like this, and that's why the student teacher is doing what they're doing and behaving the way they're behaving. Mentors very seldom come out within IT now. I don't mean just generally, because I'm sure there are a lot of mentors out there who are teachers who go off and do various different professional learning outside of their school. But they don't come out to the university environment. They don't come out into our ITE community of practice regularly to be able to have the sort of conversations like we're having now, that, oh my goodness, isn't it tricky that we're expecting this student to make that jump from two strongly constituted communities of practice be told by university that they need to interrogate, they need to inquire, all of this stuff, you know, for them to have the same eureka moment as us, that, okay, that's going to have a bearing on the way that I need to operate with my student teacher, or you know, that changes things about who I need to be as a mentor.
Yeah, and one of the real killer lines in one of the pieces of literature we read was an article by Edwards and Prothero from 2004. And they put it in quite a brutal way, and in a way we need to be careful we don't sort of make this sound like we're bashing school colleagues here, because we're not, because they say mentors' first loyalty is to the education of the pupils in their school rather than to the student teacher. And we don't say that as a criticism of mentors, because actually, you know, it's sort of blindingly obvious, really. They're employed by the school. They've got the kids involved. They're employed by the local education authority. But basically, they're employed by that school. And they've got those pupils in front of them. And their first loyalty has got to be to the learning of those pupils. And you sort of look at that and you think, gosh, that's really quite a difficult thing to wrap your head around. But then you think, well, they're in a very strong community of practice in that school. Schools are really sort of tight-knit communities. And actually, Philpott in 2014, I think, even questions whether we could even call initial teacher education, or our, you know, a partnership, an initial teacher education partnership, a community of practice, a single defined community of practice, in the way that you can call an insurance company office full of people filling in forms and making phone calls and, you know, moaning about their colleagues and that kind of thing, or in a staff room or whatever. That fits the bill of a community of practice. But when you've got hundreds of schools, or nearly 200 schools, all of us here in university, and we're all sort of flitting about this geographically very, very sort of diverse landscape, to actually describe that as a community of practice in the sense that we're all sort of connected to each other and all having these informal sort of things and making up these little tips and tricks and hacks and ways around the system. Can you even say that a mentor who sits in a classroom, in a primary, in the same classroom with the same kids, part of an IT community of practice as things stand? In some ways, it feels like a bit of a stretch.
It does. And to complicate matters further, that same school may also place student teachers from other ITE providers in Wales who are interpreting the same accreditation criteria, ITE criteria, to create their programmes, but might have different names to the names that we have, might have a different model. You know, so I think what we found, even though it's a bit of a sad thing to find out, is that we've been really aspirational. The research-informed clinical practice model is really aspirational. However, this finding about the weekly and strongly constituted communities of practice, ITE weekly, constituted schools, strongly constituted, leaves this poor student teacher in the middle of all of this, having to negotiate some of these tensions of, you want me to be this, but if I try and be that in that context, I'm working against myself, I'm self-sabotaging potentially here. And likewise, the issues and the expectations, without necessarily the support that mentors need to be the person that student teacher would need them to be.
And it's easy to make it sound like we're sort of bashing schools when we say, no. Oh, well, they've got this whole school driver for Dr. Ice, or they've got this whole school driver for Sherrington's walkthroughs, and they're kind of prodding the student to use their research and inquiry time to kind of do more Dr. Ice or do more Sherrington's walkthroughs or something like that. But when you read the Wenger and you look at this process by which the kind of old established members of staff in a community of practice draw the newbies in gradually into, oh, this is how we do things here, this is how we do things here, it's not a negative thing that they're doing. They're doing what they know in their community of practice. They're trying to bring the student teacher in to become part of the club, part of the team, part of the joint enterprise, because that's what you do in a strongly constituted community of practice. I guess the only problem is that our model is our clinical practice model is almost quite explicitly trying to work against that. So we've introduced a real friction into the system there.
anecdotally as well, but I think there are some papers out here that explain why this is quite challenging, is that any type of professional learning or sort of research influence that a teacher has, it's quite a complex process that it takes for that to then find its way into the classroom and to be integrated. An anecdote from my own experience is that I remember naively interpreting what happened after I'd been given the opportunity to go to Warwick to train with the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company, with active approaches to teaching Shakespeare. I think I might have mentioned this before on the podcast. And I'd had such a great experience, and I was really taken by this practice. I was skipping back into school, ready to share it, particularly with my English colleagues, the colleagues in the English department, and expecting it to land really well. And the reception that I got was not what I expected. Lots of skepticism, you know, and rightly so, actually. But essentially, that's sort of what we're asking students to do as well. You know, they come back to university on a regular basis on our programmes. They engage with, you know, more, you know, different types of knowledge, not necessarily just research knowledge, but, you know, again, they've got a different perspective. They come back into school. They've got to think, well, what am I going to do with that? And is that going to land here? That whole process of translation into practice, that interrogation, integration, they sound like really lovely buzzwords. But the reality of that is that is very, very difficult.
And I think, you know, we can't forget the identity of the student as well, isn't it? And their own identity and their understanding of their own identity. Because you could argue that they're quite low status in a community of practice when they enter. But yet we're expecting them to engage in some high status activity, which is challenging and questioning pedagogy and what they see and how things are done in school. And I think sometimes, you know, we've spoken before about, you know, that dual identity a student has as a new teacher and a professional who's expected to know everything, and also as a learner and somebody who doesn't know it all. So they've already got that dual identity they're struggling with, but they could also be struggling with this identity low status where they come into a school but they're still expected to be challenging. So that's on top of something already very, very difficult for them. And perhaps we don't appreciate that enough.
So where did we go from here? I guess we've articulated our conclusions, but, you know, now what? And as you said earlier on, Tom, so what for the partnership? I know that for us on the mentoring team, we had to have a really good look at, and we've talked about this in a previous episode, at how we're describing the role and responsibilities of a mentor within our partnership. And we did a lot of work over the last academic year to redesign our principles of mentoring. You know, it's not going to be a silver bullet, but such that they better represent the aspirations of what we're looking for, the sort of the knowledge, the qualities, the practices of a mentor in this type of ITE model. That's not to say that they've got the money or the time to do it well, by the way, but at least we can now say, you know, this is the sort of person that we're looking for to be able to do this stuff.
And I think we've done quite a lot of work this year as well, haven't we, on our vision within ITE, our vision of how student teachers learn. And we've sort of tried to identify what are those different elements that all, you know, are part of the learning journey for a student. And I think by being more explicit about the range of experiences and the range of things that they're to support their learning, that hopefully will impact on the student's understanding of research and inquiry as well, that research and inquiry encompasses all those aspects of teaching and learning, and some of them are more close to practice than others. So, you know, we're satisfying them on that count, but they also appreciate the whole remit of experiences that contribute to their learning journey.
And it would be, it's easy to just sort of go with a simplistic answer, isn't it? Because you could say, oh, well, you know, a school is a strongly constituted community of practice. Initial teacher education is very weakly constituted. Well, just beef up the constitution of the ITE community of practice. Yeah, not so easy, because a school is always going to have one over us, really, because they are geographically centred. They, you know, their boundaries are clear. their enterprise is very, very clear. They've got their pupils there. It's so well-defined a school, isn't it? It's so kind of easy in a way to work out what a school is for and what it's about. And ITE, Initial Teacher Education, made up of loads of schools and us and student teachers flitting about the place, we could never do it. We could never do it because we can never kind of drop ourselves into a geographical location and do one thing and do it really, really well in that way. And so what we have to do is we have to look at this mentor who is this such a central person, such a central role, and slightly rebalance or reconceptualize where they're sitting, because Wenger has this lovely term, the nexus of multi-membership. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Hey, mentors, you're at the nexus of multi-membership. But what we're trying to say is a mentor, what we're hoping, needs to be more than just somebody who is very, very good at putting an arm around a student teacher and bringing them to the centre of that school community. Great if that happens, but we're going to have to ask our mentors now to potentially deal with knowledge, ideas, strategies, things that are from outside, and to ascribe a value to those things in a way that is bigger than just what does this do for the school. So the mentor's got to kind of have a new hat now, which is the ability to see beyond the boundaries of the school, to see the student teacher as existing beyond the boundaries of the school. And yeah, okay, you know, bring them into the school environment in a really successful way, but also see things through a lens that is bigger than what does this do for my pupils. And goodness me, that is one heck of an ask, isn't it, in terms of their identity and the way that they deal with knowledge and things and ideas and disruptions.
But I think that does fit as well with the sort of vision and values of the professional standards, because the vision and values of professional standards, you know, six different visions of values, and one of them being the Welsh language, and one of them being, you know, key skills and so forth. But one of them is having a role in the wider community and understanding that as a member of the teaching profession, you're not just contributing to the life and work of that individual school, that you also belong to the more national aspirations for children's learning. So I do think that although it is a huge ask, and I agree, of mentors, it does actually align with the professional standards for teaching and leadership in Wales. It is stipulated in the values there that, you know, teachers do have that bigger picture in mind.
Yeah, and on an international level, I know that the OECD's Schools as Learning Organisations has been very influential in Wales. And so, you know, within that model, schools are encouraged to look outside of their community of practice to collaborate, so that they're not becoming their own little sort of echo chamber, that they are. And part of that process, I suppose, as a mentor, comes back to inquiry. And I guess, you know, a simple version of that is, you know, yeah, why do we do Dr. Ice, and what, how did that come to, because, you know, just depending on when you were recruited into that role, you might not know sort of the history of that, where it came from, depending on the way that schools, you know, the sort of architecture around how they do research and inquiry in this school might be quite prescriptive, or it might be a lot more sort of open and transparent about, you know, where we go to find our sources. You know, it could be that, you know, in this school we are doing, you know, I'm in charge of teaching and learning, and I have found this, and these are the reasons why, and this is why we're going to do it. But I suppose what you've not necessarily done is brought your staff on a journey as to what other things were discarded and why, and all of these things. Schools are busy places. This is not me bashing anybody's approach to whole school research and inquiry, but definitely sort of at a basic level, knowing why your school has decided to do certain things in certain ways over others is probably a good thing to know as a practitioner, and can be quite helpful to a student teacher.
It is one of the weird things about this sort of philosophy of learning to be a teacher, isn't it? Which is that the student teacher, the one who's newest to it and is doing the hardest stuff in a way, is the one who is left, as if we're not extraordinarily careful about it, which you know, clearly we've seen that we've got a bit of an issue here when we've done this research. They are left to navigate around between different schools, university, untested types of knowledge, to work out, you know, to take something that's quite abstract and bring it into context, or by themselves, really, sometimes, unless, as you say, we open this out to experienced teachers, to mentors, you know, to us as well, to some extent. You know, the student teacher has the privilege of being able to move much more between contexts and to have access to much more types of knowledge. But it's trying to do it while they're trying to get qualified at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And that sort of brings me back to another article that we reference in our yet-to-be-published article from Chemis and others, which is about practice architectures. It's about how the architecture of practice on a sort of national level, usually sort of informed by education policy, influences the doings, sayings, ways of being, and the sort of settings in which different practitioners operate and come together. In the case of that article, it was the mentors with their student teachers. And if you've got a practice architecture which dictates that your mentors are in supervisory roles and confer QTS at the end of the process, then in a way, as the article says, they're like an agent of the state. And does an agent of the state also welcome difficult conversations, dissonance, critique, bringing in new ideas? So it's very complex and it's very much sort of influence. I think there's a lot of aspiration, but at the same time, we're working within a lot of parameters that are different in different contexts, that you're right, Tom, the student teacher is often the one that has to sort of navigate that on their own occasionally.
Yeah, so important to do this research type stuff when you're working in an aspirational place. You've got to find things out. You've then got to use other things to make sense of them. And then you've got to kind of answer so what. And I suppose so what is not prepackaged simple solutions, is it? It's so what is, well, where have we got to go next with this? And there's some really, really important signposts there. Before we move on to the short slots, we should say another thank you to all those student teachers who spoke to us, and they really were very generous, as were their mentors, really generous with their time. You know, we badgered them several times during the course of the process. They said some really, really interesting stuff. And a massive thanks to friend of the podcast, Professor David James, Cardiff University, who was very, very encouraging, because we are, all three of us, early career, what they call, researchers. And he really did give us a lot of encouragement, didn't he?
He really did. He was very generous with his time. He sort of gave us the confidence to roll with these two articles, yes, didn't he?
Yes, yes. And to read some drafts as well for us and give us some key pointers, yeah, to go in the right direction.
Quite right, too. Okay, so we've done our own homework.
We've marked our own homework. That would be bad.
So we're not just going to recommend a book. We're actually going to recommend a chapter of a book. Tom, Sean Ed, I know that you know quite a lot about this particular chapter. So did you want to say about the Wenger?
Yeah, we looked at Wenger's 1998 book, didn't we? It's just called Communities of Practice. And it opens with this really interesting vignette. I mean, you say vignette, it's pretty long actually, isn't it? About this person who's working at what we could probably kindly say is a pretty menial level, paper-pushing level, within an American health insurance company. And Wenger describes the sort of working day of this person and what they do and all of that kind of thing. And it's the way into the whole book, which sort of sets out and explains this theory of the idea of the informal learning within organisations. I don't know about you, Shona, but I just found it, you know, you start off and think, what on earth could this health insurance company paper pusher sending forms backwards and forwards tell me about how people learn to be teachers? And quite quickly you realise that everything that's going on in this company, while it looks really mundane, is actually really interesting.
Oh, extremely interesting. It's like reading a novel in a way, isn't it? You know, I remember when I first read it, there was this description of this new worker, you know, going up in the lift and who else was in the lift, and then arriving at her desk, and then some talk about celebrating somebody's birthday and if there was a cake coming in on the Friday. And you just read it and think, you know, have I picked up the wrong book? What book is this about? It's really, really engaging. And only slowly do you realise what's happening. But it's the mundane, it's the ordinary, it's those things that are not sort of planned in any shape or form that actually influences that learner, well, not learner, that worker in that context, but they understand how to do their role. And actually, after a while, you understand how complex their role is. You know, they have to make some key decisions, don't they, about, you know, the healthcare and how they interview these people on the other end of the phone. But yes, I suppose it can be read in all sorts of different levels. And I think you could probably return to it again and again and understand a little bit more. But yes, very interesting.
Yeah, and it unpicks sort of what gives you status in that organisation. And some of it's kind of imposed by management, but some of it's much more informal. It unpicks the way that when you start off, you have to ask about everything. But after a while, you become the go-to person for that particular sort of thing. Oh, go and ask them. They've dealt with it. They're the absolute ninja of that thing. It unpicks the way that the leadership of the organization puts these structures in place, which kind of rule their lives. But then how the people on the shop floor very quietly work out kind of hacks and shortcuts and secret ways of getting, oh yeah, you have to write that in that box and then that'll happen, or, you know. So it's this really subtle interaction between the sort of formal and the informal, the way that learning is shared, the way that it's all sort of very much under the surface. And then once you've started to unpack it in what originally looked like a really, really mundane and boring work environment, you can start to make connections to the thing that you know. So I would really recommend reading the opening of Wenger's Communities of Practice 1998, sticking with it, as Sean had said, because you think, well, why would I want to know about this? And then it all opens up into an understanding of how this stuff works, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, because we came across some terms, didn't we, in that book that were challenging, like reification and legitimate peripheral participation. And once you've had that pretext laid out for you, it's a touch point then to come back to you to make sense of, oh, okay, so that is an example of reification, etc. So we won't go into those details, but certainly have a read of that opening chapter at least. Okay, so something to try is something that I hinted at a little bit earlier on in the episode, which is, it might seem like a bit of a mundane thing, and it might send you down a rabbit hole. We were just musing before we hit record about the things like Dr. Ice, like Sherrington's walkthroughs, like Teach Like a Champion, that find their way into schools and that have been really sort of well received and adopted. One that you mentioned just lately that's become really big, Shauna, is Voice 21, which is about sort of dialogic teaching and oracy development within schools. And what we would encourage a student teacher going into that school, or a teacher within a school that has adopted something like that, to do if they haven't done so already, is to look a little bit more deeply at why it was selected, who selected it, what the sort of research landscape is around that, or that underpins that, where it came from, so that you not only can better understand what you're trying to achieve when you're doing it in the classroom. So I think this sometimes what the sort of really close to practice, quick and easy guides do is they do tend to cover the research, but they don't tell you what they left behind or what they didn't choose, or, you know, other models that they could have gone for or practices. So you might have to do a bit of digging. You might have to talk to some senior leaders to find these things out. If you're a senior leader, you'll know, and maybe you'll take the opportunity to talk to your staff about these things, all in the spirit of understanding it better, being able to sort of explain that quite clearly to anybody you're working with, or if you're working with a student teacher, sort of you know, knowing where that came from. And avoiding something that I think it was Finola Wilson talked about in a previous episode, which is about these sort of lethal mutations that can happen when you take a practice that's come from research, but you don't really know too much about it. And then it becomes a really strange, unintended version, and, you know, bearing very little resemblance to what the original research was getting at. So that's what we would recommend as something to try. So we have covered a lot of ground in this episode. Thanks for joining us, Sioned.
You're welcome, Grisha.
We hope you found that interesting, and we'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was our research partner in crime, Sioned Davith. Thanks to Sioned for coming in. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. We're on social media at Talk Teaching Pod if you want to come and say hello. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.